see Nancy Pelosi claimed. China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs decried Pelosi's visit, accusing the United States of playing with fire and warning that those who play by fire will perish by it. In a statement, the ministry said China and the United States are two major countries. The right way for them to deal with each other lies only in mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, no confrontation, and win-win cooperation. The Taiwan question is purely an internal affair of China, and no other country is entitled to act as a judge on the Taiwan question. China strongly urges the United States to stop playing the Taiwan card and using Taiwan to contain China. It should stop meddling on Taiwan and interfering in China's internal affairs. It should stop supporting and conniving at Taiwan's independence, separatist forces in any form. It should stop its acts of saying one thing but doing the opposite on the Taiwan question. It should stop distorting, obscuring, and hauling out the One China principle. It must take credible actions to observe strictly the One China principle and the provisions of the three China-U.S. joint communiques, deliver on the five no's commitment made by U.S. leadership that is not seek a new Cold War, not seek to change China's system. The revitalization of its alliances is not against China, not support Taiwan independence, not look for conflict with China, and not go further down the wrong and dangerous path. Anti-war voices also condemned the speaker's trip. Pelosi's Taiwan visit is unnecessary, dangerous, and utterly reckless at a time when the war in Eastern Europe continues. Stop the War UK tweeted, adding, "The US is already in a proxy war with Russia, and Pelosi's visit could result in military retaliation and a dangerous cycle of escalation." Former Taiwanese Foreign Policy Planning Chief Dale G. Wenqi decried the notion that Pelosi was coming to the island to support the Taiwanese people. G. added, "You Yankees want us to buy weapons from you? Are you here to support Taiwan or to provoke a war? What the hell are you doing here, Pelosi?" The relationship between the mainland and Taiwan is already very tense. Supporting Taiwan? We don't need your support. Also recently, Taipei 101, the Taiwanese capital's tallest building and iconic landmark, displayed illuminated messages welcoming Pelosi and thanking her for visiting. The speaker's visit also prompted protests from the streets of Taipei to her hometown of San Francisco. Julie Tang, a retired San Francisco Superior Court judge, accused Pelosi of supporting the military-industrial complex and raising the temperature for war during a recent demonstration in the Northern California city. Tang told the San Francisco Standard, "We have donated to her. We've supported her throughout these years, but we are so disappointed that what she's doing is totally against the welfare and the well-being of the community, in particular Chinese Americans." Tang added, "She does not listen to us. She's going with the flow, going with pushing U.S. hegemony to contain China. For what? They don't get anything out of it. Biden administration officials had reportedly been working behind the scenes to convince Pelosi of the potential dangers of visiting Taiwan. Last month, Biden admitted that U.S. military officials believed it's not a good idea for Pelosi to visit Taiwan right now. Midstream.
In light of the recent movements of the Sadrist movement supporters and the storming of the House of Representatives, the scene in Iraq may be on the verge of more popular unrest, especially in light of a call for opposing demonstrations targeting what it called financial and administrative corruption. Protests by supporters of the Sadrist movement continue in Baghdad's Tahrir Square in refusal to hold a possible session of the House of Representatives with the aim of electing a president and a prime minister. As a result, Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament, Muhammad al-Halbousi, announced the suspension of parliament sessions until further notice, against the background of demonstrators storming the parliament and the Green Zone. Supporters of the Sadrist movement announced their sit-in inside the parliament headquarters in protest against the coordination framework's adherence to the nomination of Mohammad Shaya' al-Sudani for the position of prime minister. Meanwhile, Iraqi President Barham Saleh called for the launch of a national dialogue between the political parties in order to solve the political impasse in the country. In turn, the head of the State of Law Coalition, Nur al-Maliki, called on the coordination framework and the Sadrist movement to a responsible stance that absorbs the shock and initiates a serious dialogue, stressing that dialogue and tolerance between political parties is the only way to put an end to the deterioration in the country. It seems that Iraq has entered the stage of the Shia-Shia conflict that many regional players have been warning of since the legislative elections that were held last October produced two major Shia parties, each with its own project. Iraqi observers fear that the country is on the verge of a major escalation, which some describe as personal, between the leader of the Sadr movement, Muqtada Sadr, and his rival, former Prime Minister Nur al-Maliki, whose supporters responded to Sadr supporters' storming of the Green Zone by storming an area nearby, showcasing their weapons. The Sadrists tend to put their move within the framework of a warning message, aiming to push the coordinating framework to withdraw the candidacy of Mohammad Shaya' al-Sudani, who is affiliated with al-Maliki, and to present another option similar to that of Haider al-Abadi, or to keep the government of Mustafa al-Qadhimi until holding new elections. What happened in the Green Zone is translated by many Iraqis as an escalation by al-Sadr, who no longer has a political arm to translate his demands into state institutions. However, if the general trend is to reproduce the experience of the October Revolution, that is to use the streets violently, then Iraq is looking at a long, hot summer that no doubt will end in flames. Welcome to the Midstream, I'm Marwa Osman. Muqtada Sadr did not delay long before waiving the option of mass rallies, an abrupt invasion of parliament, which was clear and specific, a withdrawal from the nomination of Mohammad Shaya' al-Sudani to head the government, a regression which opens the door to the possibility of an additional escalation whose consequences are unknown. All the while, a Shia infighting in Iraq last week returned to retreat with the restart of communications mediated by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Assad so far seems to be betting to get his opponents to make concessions so as not to slip into an unwelcome strife. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist at the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar and political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us. Mr. Hamza, now, why did Assad choose to direct his supporters to storm the Iraqi parliament in protest of nominating Mohammad Shaya' al-Sudani by the coordinating framework for the position of prime minister? I mean, why did the tactic have to be so hard to a point that would risk an actual Shia-Shia confrontation?
Greetings to you. Sayed Muqtada Sadr felt that the Iraqi Coordinating Framework Coalition transcended the move made by Sadr movement of withdrawing their MPs from the Iraqi parliament. The Coordinating Framework moved on by firstly naming new MPs instead of those Sadr withdrew from parliament. These new MPs, according to Iraqi law, are those who were at the top of the losing list in the last legislative elections, meaning this move is illegal. These MPs are part of different factions under the Coordinating Framework Coalition. Therefore, majority in parliament became in the hands of the Coordinating Framework, giving it, as per the Iraqi constitution, the legitimacy to form a new cabinet and nominate a new prime minister presented by Mohammad Shaya' al-Sudani to head the cabinet. This move was not anticipated by Sayed Muqtada Sadr, who thought that the coordinating framework has too many differences amongst its affiliates to a point that they won't be able to name a new prime minister. However, Sayed Sadr felt that he was left behind and that the coordinating framework is moving on above all hardships and heading towards naming Mohammad Shaya' al-Sudani as the new head of government. As such, the reaction of Sayed Muqtada Sadr was strong and somewhat violent, especially by allowing his supporters to invade the Green Zone, storm the parliament, and stage a sit-in inside the parliament headquarters. This move was a strict one that was followed by several other stiff conditions presented to Mr. Hadi Al-Amiri, head of the Al-Fatah coalition, who proposed to go to a national dialogue and to halt the strategy of street protests that might ignite Iraq.
Well, Mr. Hamza, a Sadr movement could have easily been part of the parliament nominations to elect a new prime minister, but they choose to withdraw. They withdrew from the parliament. They chose to leave their seats at the parliament. Then they already had their own nomination of Mohammad Ja'far Sadr to head the government as well. Why did they not stay in parliament and nominate their own candidate to see if the members of parliament would actually vote for him or not?
We can briefly say that the situation in Iraq is as follows. Sayed Muqtada Sadr withdrew his MPs from the parliament and sent in his supporters to invade it instead. As you just said, he could have continued with his political process inside parliament by nominating a candidate to head the new cabinet or to at least reach a consensus with other political blocs on a candidate for the position of prime minister. However, according to sources close to Sayed Muqtada Sadr, it seems that in this new era after the legislative elections in which he claims to have won a majority, Sayed Sadr did not like the fact that he was not able to nominate his own candidate, Mohammad Ja'far al-Sadr. Neither the coordinating framework accepted this nomination, nor did Sadr's own Kurdish allies accept it. Hence, the necessary approvals needed to make sure Sadr candidates for both the office of prime minister and of the presidency make it to office were no longer available. Sadr realized late after the elections ended that the results were not completely in his favor to allow him to move forward with his own agenda.
So he was basically happy with the results of the elections at first, but now on the ground when he saw that he doesn't really have majority, he didn't like it anymore?
Yes, sure. You can see that in media outlets affiliated to Muqtada Sadr that made sure to propagate that the result of the elections was a complete swooping win in favor of Sadr, which was not the real case. A lot of observers and legislatives tried to explain that the election result does not imply a complete majority for Sadr movement in parliament, and that the result won't be enough to topple Sadr's main foe, Nouri al-Maliki, from Iraqi politics. This is what Sayed Muqtada Sadr is trying to do in the political saga going on in Iraq. He is trying to deny any leverage for Nouri al-Maliki, which the latest election results had proved that Maliki has retained support and representation within the Iraqi political spectrum.
Which is why, Mr. Hamza, a lot of people are saying that the country is on the threshold of a major escalation, if not a conflict, that can be described as personal. A lot of analysts in Iraq are saying this is a personal problem between the leader of the Sadr movement, Muqtada al-Sadr, and his rival, former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Do you agree with this?
Yes, it is so. To a large extent, the political rift in Iraq is a personal one between Muqtada al-Sadr and Nouri al-Maliki. Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr has yet to forget the campaign that Nouri al-Maliki had launched against him when he was in office as Prime Minister. At that time, al-Maliki had accused Sadr of harboring militias that are taking control of the Iraqi streets, violating Iraqi law and overstepping on the role of the Iraqi army. And strangely enough, today we hear Sayyid Muqtada Sadr supporters calling for the dissolving of what they refer to as the militias belonging to Iran. Even journalists and political commentators who are affiliated with Sadr use such slogans in the media. Even Sayyid Sadr himself keeps repeating that he aims to rid the government from corruption and corrupted politicians and to begin reforms in Iraq. However, this is such a strange phase that Iraq is passing through today, since a personal vendetta between two political figures is causing Sayyid Sadr use the same accusations that Maliki used against Sadr politicians when he was in office. We see now Sadr using this same technique of accusations against Nouri al-Maliki. The base of the conflict in Iraq now is a personal one, simply because there is no chemistry between Sadr and Maliki. This is what is putting an entire country on the line today.
Well, it's really amazing for me, because if there's no chemistry between two personas, we take the entire country to flames. That's something I could never understand. But I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, a journalist at the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar and political commentator, for joining us to tell us what you think about where Iraq really is going. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Iraq also has another battle with Turkey.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The complaint submitted by the Iraqi Ministry of Foreign Affairs to the UN Security Council against Turkey, blaming it for the bombing of the tourist resorts in the Zaho district of northern Iraq on July 20, Baghdad, through its foreign minister Fuad Hussein, accused Turkey of violating Iraq's sovereignty 22,740 times since 2018. Meanwhile, Baghdad submitted 296 complaints against these violations, and they are still ongoing. If the number of violations since 2018 is only this amount, then the total of number of violations since about 40 years is uncountable. Iraq pushes back on Turkey's domination in this following report.
On July 27, Iraq lodged a complaint against Turkey at the UN Security Council, and the Iraqi resistance fired rockets at the Turkish consulate in Mosul. Both actions were taken in retaliation for a July 20 Turkish artillery strike that killed 9 Iraqis and wounded 33 in the Kurdistan region resort of Parakh. They were also the most recent incidents in a conflict that has spanned decades, largely out of sight, and is now escalating quantitatively and qualitatively. The Security Council issued a statement last week condemning the attack on the resort in the strongest terms, expressing support for Iraqi authorities in their investigations, and urging all countries to cooperate with the Iraqi government and all other relevant authorities in support of these investigations. The Council, however, did not mention Turkey. after the Turkish attack on the Iraqi province of Duhok. Retaliation by the Iraqi resistance was sure to follow. On the same night of the attack, Iraqi resistance fighters launched two attacks: a drone strike against a Turkish artillery fire base at Bamerni in northern Duhok, and a rocket strike on the Turkish base at Zilkan in Nineveh province. The potential conflict between Turkey and the Iraqi resistance has been escalating as Turkey greatly expanded its drone strikes, not only blanketing the border and Kandil areas, but also striking as far as 175 miles inside Iraq, hitting federally controlled areas such as Sinjar and Mosul. In many cases, Bayraktar drone crews track and target PKK leadership figures by either following them as they travel south from the border area or detecting them via spies on the ground if they enter urban areas. Yet Turkey's deep pursuit of the PKK has also brought it into areas where the group's networks interlace with Iraqi resistance forces, creating a cycle of escalation that threatens to spiral out of control. This is most notable in Sinjar, where the Iraqi resistance Izadi allies reside. Ankara's actions in these areas, such as targeting senior Izadi militia commanders and killing civilians at Parakh, have drawn escalating resistance rocket and drone attacks on its bases in Iraq, which usually prompts Turkish artillery, air, and drone strikes on the resistance. Ultimately, Ankara has no business maintaining a large, provocative, unilaterally established military bases as deep inside Iraq as Zilkan. The latest rocket strikes on the Mosul consulate show that this base and the brash incursion policy it represents are bad for Turkey and will lead to an Iraqi retaliation.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire and producer and host at TNT Radio. And I thank you very much for being with us, Patrick, to discuss this very important issue at hand now in Iraq, as the dispute between Iraq and Turkey over the recent deadly attack that took place in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region escalates. Iraq's foreign minister demanded that all Turkish troops withdraw from his country, while we heard the Turkey's deputy ambassador say that his government will keep pursuing fighters it considers as terrorists who, according to Turkey, are taking refuge in Iraq. Where do you see the crisis between both countries headed towards?
Yeah, this is a very difficult situation. This isn't the first time as well that Turkey's mounted incursions in northern Iraq, as you know, nor with any of its neighbors, Syria being the most key example there. So the main problem here is Turkey is basically asserting what it thinks is its sovereignty or its independent decision-making to pursue anti-terror operations or its own version of this special military operation. And certainly it's going to point to the United States, it's going to point to Russia, and it's going to point to these different countries and saying, hey, they're doing it, so we have a right to secure our interests as well vis-a-vis the terrorist issue that we believe is threatening our country. So this is the big problem. The other big problem is they have the NATO cloak of invincibility, which they use very deftly, and it's a very convenient additional banner that Turkey can fly that leaves the other Western countries a little bit hands-off, the other UN Security Council members a little bit hands-off. So Turkey's a very skillful operator, and it's using the various angles in order to position itself to do what it wants to do. And that might fly in the face of international law, but they don't seem to be too concerned about that.
Well, Patrick, the Iraqi government sought an emergency meeting for the UN Security Council last week after the July 20 artillery attack that killed 9 Iraqi tourists and injured 33 others in the resort. Now, Iraq says that it does have proof that the Turkish armed forces were actually responsible for this massacre that happened. Now, Turkey, on the other hand, has obviously denied that it was behind the attack, and it's blaming the PKK, Kurdistan Workers Party, for this attack, which by the way, is considered as a terrorist organization by both Ankara and also the Western regimes. Now, but if Iraq actually has evidence that proves viable, what can be expected of the Security Council towards Turkey?
It really depends if there's any political will there by the Security Council or by any of these Western countries to prosecute that case. And Turkey immediately is going to point, if the Turkey gets any pressure on this, they're going to claim, even if there is evidence, they could say, well, it's unfortunate collateral damage, or they could say they can continue to blame the PKK, but they'll just point to Kiev. They'll point to the Ukrainian forces that have been hitting civilians pretty much continuously for the last 8 years, but really intensely in the last few months in the Donbass. Mm-hmm. So, and that really sort of neutralizes the Western argument. And they don't want to get into that type of an argument internationally, so then they'll just keep it submerged. They'll keep the issue sort of on the back burner. It's not going to get a lot of press coverage. And if there's not a lot of media coverage, there's not going to be enough international uproar generated in order to create the political will to make something happen about this. That's really how the game works. Turkey really understands this game now because they've learned from the masters. They've learned from the United States and their allies, and they're playing that game and quite well at the moment, to the detriment of people in Iraq.
And they played from the ultimate criminal in West Asia, which is the Zionist entity, by targeting civilians, if that's the case, and Iraq actually have evidence for it. But Turkey claims that Iraq has so far proven to be either unable or unwilling to fight what Ankara actually brands as terrorists in northern Iraq. I've heard that somewhere. And therefore, Ankara believes that Iraq cannot blame Turkey for exercising what Turkey says it's a right to self-defense inside the Iraqi territories. Wow. What's your take on that?
Firstly, I just want to add that previously the Israeli-Palestine example is another thing Turkey will use to throw back at the West regarding civilians. But on the front you're talking about, you know, it's really difficult for Baghdad to be able to manage its national security interests because the U.S. has U.S.-backed and Israeli-backed sort of autonomous state, artificial state in Iraqi Kurdistan. And the reason that that's happened over history has basically hamstrung Baghdad in order to take full control over its own affairs and borders, as we've seen in recent years. So this is a big problem. So you shouldn't expect Turkey is going to heed any statements by Baghdad on this, because they're just going to ignore them, quite frankly. And then they're just going to say we have to flush out this PKK problem. And you know, any expectation Iraq has in stopping that is going to be deemed unrealistic, because the wider geopolitical forces are going to trump the international law by the letter and the security interests of Baghdad. And that's unfortunate, but this is where we're at right now.
But it seems that the Iraqi resistance is not taking it from Turkey, and we've seen the Turkish consulate in Mosul being targeted. Do you think that there's potential of an escalation between Iraqi resistance fighters and Turkey this time, not only with the PKK?
Yeah, and this is where it will get really complicated for Turkey, because in Syria, Turkey's been allowed to sort of make incursions into northern Syria, and it's been sort of hands-off. You've got a NATO Article 5 problem that people would have to contend with. They've got all sorts of problems. But it's a different story. Turkey operating in Iraq with Iraqi militia forces that might respond, that's much more complicated for Turkey. They're not going to be able to have any political sway over whether that's going to happen or not, and that actually could influence this situation and maybe push Turkey or make them reconsider what they're doing. So that would be a game changer if that happened.
Definitely, but I still have a minute where I want to ask you, Patrick, about the possibility of Turkey taking responsibility of the attack if Iraq actually provides the evidence. Do you think that Turkey might actually take the diplomatic step here and acknowledge that it did actually make a mistake?
I don't think so. This has like become the cardinal sin of politics internationally, is you never admit that you ever did anything wrong. Mm-hmm. You deny, and then you bury, and then you move on. And it's very rare that you ever get a mea culpa from any government. So I wouldn't, you know, hold my breath for that at all. And even if it was proven, as we've seen so many times in Palestine or in Syria, and et cetera, in Donbass, it has no effect whatsoever. on, you know, the basic decision-making of the so-called international.
Well, it's very sad for the wounded and for the fallen, also victims. But I want to thank you very much from London, Mr. Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire and also host and producer at TNT Radio. Thank you very much for joining us to talk about this very crucial matter between Iraq and Turkey. And I want to thank you very much for being loyal audience to the Mideast Stream. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The latest military exercise exacerbates the patriarchal and racialized defense cooperation between Washington and Tokyo. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Koz Akibayashi and Suzuyo Katazato activist. This article is published under the heading "The Patriarchal and Militarized Impacts of RIMPAC on Okinawa and Japan." Stay tuned for more. In its Article 9, the Japanese Constitution, promulgated in 1946 under the U.S. post-war occupation, renounces war as a means of resolving international disputes and proscribes maintaining land, sea, and air forces. This article is widely supported by the Japanese people. To those in countries and areas in Asia that Japan invaded and colonized during the Asia-Pacific War, Article 9 is a pledge by the Japanese people not to repeat colonial and military violence. RIMPAC 2022 is exacerbating further the hostile environment in the region, imposing more burden on the people of Okinawa. Yet, in the early period of the Cold War, the U.S. occupation changed its course from disarming Japan to turning it into a bulwark against the communist bloc. Around the time of the Korean War, Japan started to rearm itself, first with the National Police Reserve, which soon became the Japan Self-Defense Forces, JSDF. Despite the persistent argument by peace activists that the JSDF is a breach of Article 9, the Japanese government has won public support for the JSDF through decades of promoting the forces as a disaster rescue organization and an insistence on an exclusively defense-oriented policy. The JSDF have now grown to be one of the world's largest militaries. In addition to this fundamental contradiction concerning the position of an armed force, the Japanese constitution encounters a profound problem because Article 9 was never implemented on Okinawa, the southernmost archipelago of the country that was directly occupied by the U.S. military from 1945 to 1972. Even after Okinawa's reversion to the Japanese administration, the U.S. military continued to be stationed in Okinawa, which consists of only 0.6% of the entire landmass of Japan, yet hosts about 70% of the U.S. military facilities in Japan. These Okinawan facilities have catered to the various needs of the U.S. military in waging wars in Asia and beyond. Meanwhile, for more than 7 decades, the U.S. military has violated the basic human rights, safety, and security of the people of Okinawa with virtual impunity. The U.S.-Japan military alliance has caused tremendous negative impacts on the people of the host community, including contamination of the soil and water by toxic materials, unbearable noise caused by military training, and sexual violence committed by the troops and other personnel, to name a few. The upgraded RIMPAC 2022, with the largest ever number of participating countries, reinforces the military ties between the United States and Japan. To this year's RIMPAC 2022, Japan Maritime Self-Defense Force is sending its largest vessel, JS Izumo, and other vessels and aircrafts, including JS Takanami, JS Kurisame, P-1 maritime patrol aircraft and others, as well as about 1,000 troops. Although Izumo is categorized as a helicopter destroyer, it underwent modification in recent years to become effectively an aircraft carrier with increased interoperability with the U.S. military, and where fighter jets such as F-35B of the U.S. Marine Corps can land and launch. The JSDF units participating in RIMPAC 2022 are part of their annual Indo-Pacific deployment, which lasts for several months and involves other joint exercises and calls to various ports in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. Under the strategy of open and free Indo-Pacific, a central framework of Japan's defense policies laid out in the most recent defense white paper, this is part of the intensification of the military alliance against China led by the U.S. in the Indo-Pacific region. This ideology of deterrence involving the competitive exhibit of coercive power is a deeply masculine and militarized idea. This patriarchal ideology and the structure of the security policies undermine the security and well-being of people, particularly those who are made vulnerable and deprived of their autonomy. As feminist peace activists or scholars have pointed out, these JSDF activists have already gone beyond the exclusively self-defense-oriented policy, yet public discussion on the issue is hardly found in Japan. It is partly because there is very little media coverage, and also because the negative impacts of reinforced militarization disproportionately affect only a small portion of the entire Japanese population, most notably the people of Okinawa, which constitutes a racist aspect of the military security of Japan and the U.S. The Japanese government is also moving forward with its plan to construct a new massive U.S. military facility in Henoko, which the people of Okinawa have long opposed and which even a conservative U.S. think tank believes won't be completed in a decade. Last year, it was revealed that the JSDF and the U.S. military made a secret agreement in 2015 to station the JSDF's amphibious unit at the Henoko facility. This planned replacement of the U.S. Marine Corps Futenma Air Station has proven to be equipped with more functions than air-to-air station to become a staging area for display of U.S.-Japan deterrent power in the region around Taiwan against China. The JSDF has been slowly and carefully increasing and consolidating its presence in Okinawa, which has required overcoming a deep-seated antagonism that goes back to the Japanese Imperial Army's strategy during the last stage of the Asia-Pacific War to protect the emperor in Tokyo. By prolonging the ground battle in Okinawa, now the JSDF, as evident in the secret deal with the U.S. military, is gaining more of a foothold in and around Okinawa, particularly on the small remote islands of Miyakojima and Yonaguni, as it replaces the U.S. deterrent capabilities near the Taiwan Strait. Once again, Okinawa is being made the forefront of the military strategies of Japan and the U.S. The U.S. military stationed in Okinawa continues to be a source of insecurity for the people of Okinawa. PFOS and PFAS, toxic materials with possible carcinogenicity used for fire extinguishers by the U.S. military, was found outside the military bases and even in the drinking water. Troops have been arrested for drunk driving and crimes against the local population. Service members have committed sexual assaults. U.S. military aircraft dropped their parts and other materials in civilian residential areas. Stray munitions have damaged civilian homes. And these are not accidents, rather they represent a structural problem of militarism, which prioritizes the military activities and values and of a patriarchal and racialized defense alliance, which fans the flames of military competition. RIMPAC 2022 is exacerbating further the hostile environment in the region, imposing more burden on the people of Okinawa. Article 9 has become an even hollower provision of the Japan Constitution. RIMPAC is a giant step in the wrong direction for peace in the region. A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Animation has broken new ground as the animated film Dolphin Boy became a box office hit in Russia, the film's distributor. In just 2 weeks since its premiere in that country, the film made ticket sales of about $1.7 million. Made by 2022 by Skyframe Studios in Tehran, it has been selling in Russia and Central Asia. Its Persian version is to debut in Iranian cinemas in September, and its Turkish version in Turkey in October. The soundtrack for each version will be different. It is to be the local music of the host country. I got to view the making of this feature-length animation series firsthand. Animation is technology, modern software techniques of bringing the frozen to motion. But it all begins with an idea and art, drawing and 3D modeling to end in big bucks for the makers and a boost to the economy, provided decision makers award it consistent attention and support based on careful planning. For a peek into this world of wonders, stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, on Iran Today. Mr. Khairandish is writer, director, and sketcher for Dolphin Boy. He tells of what inspired him and where he sees his work headed.
Salam. Vakti sohbat az animation mishe, ma mikhaim yeki
huzeh. When we talk about animation, we want to see areas that we don't see in our real life in an animated piece for it to be dreamlike. This dream has happened to me in some areas, one of which is the sea. Underwater life is extraordinary for us. It's like living in outer space. This was always on my mind, keeping me busy to see how creatures living in the sea would be. And since I wanted to be relatable for us, I used sea mammals, that is, creatures who once lived on land, went swimming and liked water so much that they stayed there. Dolphins and whales are like this. And when the idea for the design occurred to me, a little boy who is raised in the sea by dolphins and lives with them, this seemed to be the main focus of my work, and it happened.
Our director insists on 2 points. First, that the industry won't pick up as it should unless it is privatized. And second, that copyright law must be amended. Because right now, foreign films can be easily downloaded from domestic online film sites, and so people go for these free copies, while Iranian quality films must be paid for and so remain on the shelves. But there is an alternative to observing foreign copyright. These domestic film sites can funnel some of their income from pirate animation copies into Iran's animation industry, perhaps, without investing. Mr. Hamedani is producer at Skyframe. He takes on a portion of what's to be conveyed.
For example, when you see a film, an Iranian film, so you can recognize that it is Iranian, but when you see an animation, it is not clear that where has been made. So it is a treat of the animation in copyright of Iran. So when you're publishing an animation in platforms, even your audience cannot recognize as well it is an Iranian animation or it is foreigner. So it makes our work more difficult, more tough.
The show today is on animation in Iran. But what better current example than Dolphin Boy to learn of this country's know-how and what it can mean for the country? Dolphin Boy's international success shows that the Iranian animation film industry has a promising future.
I think if we can expand our market and we can introduce our talent and our potential to the world, we can be a replacement of some Western countries, like, for example, Canada was replacing of USA because of the less amount of the salaries, but the good quality. But I think our talent can replace to the Canada, for example, to making pre-production and post-production.
Mr. Esmaili, the production manager, in telling of the challenges in getting the freshly molded characters off the production line and into the market, gives Dolphin Boy a pat on the back.
The Dolphin Boy animation is among the top ones across Asia and even Europe. In fact, unlike the US, animation industry is not that advanced in the EU countries. This animation can have a saying in the world. We can even say that it seeks a rival in every field of animation making, say script, character design, artistic aspect, technicality, story and everything. By this animation, Iran has proudly won a good place in the world.
The film tells of a little boy's adventures at sea as his plane crashes and a dolphin saves him from the waves. The two, fish and boy, grow up together, with boy braving the bad and finding himself before a dilemma when the villainous octopus unintentionally helps him find his mother. Given the interest it's provoked and its success at sales beyond homeland borders, the film certainly can't be ignored by authorities, whom every animation producer hopes for support from. We got a pretty rounded picture of the workings of the charming studios we visited as we got to talk to several supervisors working on colorful animations. Mr. Memorian explains pre-production and how complex and time-consuming it is in simple terms.
In total, there are three main stages in animation production. One is called pre-production, then there is the actual production and the post-production. Our guys with different skills are working on these three stages. The stage that we're working on is called layout. If I want to describe layout to make it clear for the audience, it is the link between the pre-production unit and a production unit for an animated feature. The pre-production unit is more about the initial idea, the script, and the artists in the unit design the scenes and plans in 2D illustration. And we have an example of it here. The work here is being done in 2D, we call it the storyboard, and they illustrate this story's narrative shot by shot in a linear format.
Mr. Farsi reviews the detail of the aesthetics of the work as art director of Dolphin Boy.
You have an empty screen, there is nothing on it. You have to get it to be like this. You have to focus on every detail. There should be light here, rim light should be here. There should be an ink spot on his arm because he's painting his house. So everything must be in its right place.
Talking of expectation of authority, what most hands at work call for is...
Personally, I believe in a privatized economy. I think the government has to intervene to promote the proper cultural background because it is in the scope of its duties. The government should be active in three areas of politics, economy and culture because they are the three pillars of a nation. If we take a good look, we see that animation is influential at least on the economy and culture, and in my opinion, this presence is necessary.
Animation is all about making a real world of endless imaginations and still life. With a little more support to the industry, financial goals can be achieved as well as a mass of cultural goals. Well, our hunky devil octopus has done pretty well thus far, together with Dolphin and Boy, the film heroes. But why was the bad guy the more alluring at first sight, at least to me, in the tale of a spiritual journey?
Characters are not all bad. After all, anyone who turns bad has their own specific reasons, and some people may give this right to the bad characters. In the meantime, we have tried to design the negative characters in this animation in a way that they are still popular and lovely.
While the art of animation as practiced in modern-day Iran started in the 1950s, the oldest example of animation in this country goes back 5,000 years and more. I'm referring to an animated piece on an earthen goblet found in the burned city in southeastern Iran. It's probably the world's first animation portraying a goat that jumps toward a tree and eats its leaves. According to our director, it was a praiseworthy attempt at animation for its time.
Naturally, Iranians of the past should have used a shutter, but they did not have the technology. In fact, this vase or pot or whatever needs to spin, and the images appear before the eyes of the viewers one by one in fast speed. This happens frame by frame.
Iran's past and present attempt at animation has been praiseworthy. Hadi Mohammadi, director of The Elephant King and The Princess of Rome, said, We have to take into consideration that other countries have been producing animation for about 100 years, and we have been making cinematic animation for a decade. But definitely, we are not 90 years behind them, because we have taken many steps and we should try to use the same experiences correctly, instead of reinventing the wheel. But I think Iran is progressing faster than others. Having pointed to education, where do animators here get their training, and how do they put that training to use? Given the recent renewed success in the field, I would have expected animation to be absorbing brains to prevent their outward migration. To assess the situation, I've come to Sabah Animation Center.
Animation production is a technological production. It's accompanied by technology. A lot of them use software that they have developed. They have adapted the software by themselves with today's production conditions. And we have almost cutting-edge technological capabilities for animation production. As I have been informed, at least a third of the companies that work with us are startups. And thank God they are very successful at what they do.
Iran, the world's first monotheist nation as we know it, has an ancient culture rich in mythological characters. What better source of adapting and creating heroic characters for children by animation, this vital form of culture-building media?
What we have is a profound and rich culture that many countries may lack. We have a profound literature and literary and cultural leaders and wisdom and lessons in our ancient books, in Bustan by Saadi and in Divan-e Kabir by Maulana, and many wisdoms that are bound in our literature, and even Japanese animators made use of our ancient stories at the beginning of their animation production, like Amir Arsalan. Many of their animations used our stories, Iranian stories.
More coming up, but only after a quick media break to see what other outlets have said. And here it is in writing. On Iranian film and competition, Tehran Times reads, DAFC Productions to compete in Turku Animated Film Festival. Three animations from Iran's Documentary, Experimental and Animation Film Center, DAFC, competed in the 7th edition of the Turku Animated Film Festival in Finland. The Fourth Wall, The Hand and the Egg, and The Wet Mirror showcased in different sections of the festival, which took place in Turku from August the 24th to 28th. The acclaimed movie The Fourth Wall, directed by Mahbubeh Kaloi, has been selected to be screened in the international competition. It is about a stuttering boy who transforms an Iranian kitchen into a fantastic cosmos. The father's body becomes a refrigerator, the mother's belly a washing machine, whose spin cycle gives birth to a screaming baby. Even birds on tiles and detergents have a surprising life of their own. The Hand and the Egg will be shown in the TAFF TAF Junior category. Directed by Fatemeh Qaravi Manjili, the movie follows a cheerful little girl who meets a tiny bird right before her egg goes missing. She decides to help her find it. Going on a journey together, they find out that a mysterious long hand is stealing all the eggs. The Wet Mirror, directed by Amir Hushang Moin, was previously screened at the 2021 Animatrix Animation Festival in Helsinki, Finland. The film tells the story of an old painter who falls in love with a young girl. He has been painting love stories for many years. Today, it is his turn to be portrayed. Tornado Pics tells of a couple of Iranian films that have won awards in 2022. Iranian films Gilgamesh and Red Wisdom won awards at Indian Culture Cinema 2022. That's an Indian film festival that explores the cultures of the world. Gilgamesh, directed by Hossein Moradizadeh, was selected as the best mythology film at the closing ceremony of the festival on July the 23rd. Produced by the Institute for the Intellectual Development of Children and Youth, the film shows Gilgamesh failing in his constant quest for immortality. However, he finds a plant that has the power of regeneration that can help restore his youth, but a snake steals the plant after Gilgamesh leaves it on the beach while swimming. The animated film Red Wisdom, also directed by Moradizadeh, won the award for Best Film in Philosophy. The film follows a bird flying through the sky, landing near a spring and getting trapped. 10 men pull the nets and spin. In this rotation, the bird becomes a human.
The man finds himself trapped in chains that extend to the sky. On the way, he meets an old man with a long red beard and his body hair full of light. The old man plots the way to reach Mount Qaf. Seymour flies out of his nest and the man follows him, opening his arms, and his hands grow into two wings. Seymour goes to a temple in the clouds. The man finds his chain and opens it. The man flies with his wings in the sky, then sits by a puddle and slowly plunges into the water. When he gets out of the water, he turns into a bird again and flies away. The film was produced at the Documentary Experimental and Animated Film Center, DAFC. That'll be for the news section. Profits are relative. A single company in America can make more from a film than Iran's whole oil industry by its crude sales. Mr. Farsi mentions Minions too.